loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by Brian Becker. In our first hour, we'll begin a new regular segment reviewing the top stories of the week. But before we get to that, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, a federal prosecutor in the Eastern District of Virginia accidentally revealed yesterday that WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange has been indicted in the district, and the indictment is sealed. Assange's name was accidentally included in an unrelated terrorism and child pornography case. Next, an announcement by North Korea that they have developed an unspecified new tactical weapon is causing controversy. The Hawkish Center for Strategic and International Studies think tank said this week that they had discovered 13 supposedly secret North Korean missile development sites. President Trump, however, said that he's known all about the sites for a long time. Is the intelligence community trying to sabotage the Korean peace talks? Then, regional leaders gathered in Singapore this week for the summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. The intense competition for influence in the region between China and the United States was fully on display at this high-profile gathering. And then 631 people are now missing and 66 are dead in the devastating California wildfires. Thousands of other people are living in tent cities after their homes were destroyed. Meanwhile, President Trump said that he will visit California tomorrow to inspect the damage. This was after he tweeted that the fires were the fault of California's Democratic elected officials. And finally, again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week. And in other headlines, a Pentagon spokesperson said that approximately 10% of the 7,200 U.S. soldiers stationed throughout Africa would be gradually withdrawn. The U.S. military created the Africa Command, or AFRICOM, in 2007 and began escalating its presence in the continent under the pretext of the War on Terror. The spokesperson said that the redeployment was motivated by a desire to prepare, quote, for long-term competition with China and Russia, unquote. Senator Chuck Grassley announced today that he will be stepping down as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee and instead will be taking over leadership of the Senate Finance Committee. In his role on the Judiciary Committee, Grassley played a leading role in the confirmation of President Trump's Supreme Court nominees. Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican of South Carolina, is expected to take over Grassley's old role. Mississippi Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith, a Republican, is facing heavy criticism for a newly released recording of comments she made on the campaign trail. In the recording, which Hyde-Smith insists was a joke, she said, quote, "There's a lot of liberal folks in those other schools who that maybe we don't want to vote. Maybe we want to make it just a little more difficult. So I think that's a great idea," unquote. Voter suppression, especially against African-American voters, has been a major issue in the midterm elections. Exports have resumed from the oil fields near the disputed Iraqi city of Kirkuk. The dispute over control of the city, linked to an independence referendum, brought the country to the brink of civil war last year between the central government and the Kurdish regional government in the north. The resumption of oil exports comes as a new national government takes office, cooling political tensions. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the week in review. Today we begin a new hour-long segment every Friday that we're calling the week in review. We'll talk about the most important events in the week and offer some analysis to put it all into perspective. We're joined in studio by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on Facebook. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Walter, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Well, I'm excited that we're doing this segment every week. We're going to spend about 30 minutes looking at the domestic issues, 30 minutes looking at international foreign policy. Again, we could make this 5 hours, 6 hours. We could make this an 8 hour long show. But mercifully for our audience, it's just 1 hour and it's going to be fast-paced and action-packed. And there's so much to talk about. And frequently, of course, because it is the news, a lot of it is not that great.
Right.
And when we talk about the domestic situation and talking about not great news, in fact, terrible news, we have to start with the wildfires that are, in fact, ravaging whole parts of California, whole neighborhoods, the number of people dead, going up every day. The number of people missing now, apparently, according to the recent news sources, over 600 missing. Wow. Jackie, this is sort of like looking into the future, and it doesn't look that good.
Yeah, I mean, California experiences wildfires, and other places in the country, in the Midwest, in the drier areas, they experience wildfires pretty much every year in the dry seasons. But now we're seeing these wildfires be much more intense, move a lot faster, and be harder to control. And there's not as much moisture in the air. So, I mean, there is a climate change factor here. But there's also a bad politics factor in the damage that's done. And honestly, who's going to pay for it? We hate to talk about that in the context of this kind of a disaster where 63 are dead so far and over 600 are missing.
And there have already been suits filed, though,
yes,
against Pacific Electric and Gas, mm-hmm, which I guess is supposed to be the fall guy, even though nobody's determined yet how these fires began.
Exactly. They think that it's PG&E. But the interesting thing about the lawsuits against PG&E is that if they are found to have followed all of the regulations that they should have, even if they're found to be somewhat responsible, they will not pay for the lawsuits. The lawsuits will be paid for by bonds that are issued by the state, and the costs of those bonds will be passed off to PG&E consumers.
It's crazy. Just crazy.
It's awful. And this was a bill that was passed, SB 901, I think, by Jerry Brown last year, after another spate of enormous and deadly wildfires that PG&E was implicated in.
You know, Barron's magazine, the financial magazine, had an article about 6 months ago where they said that PG&E was a buy, right? You should go out and buy PG&E stock for exactly the reason that you just told us about, Jackie, and that is that no matter how bad things get, PG&E is not going to have to pay. Mm-hmm. And so they're flush with cash. They get to keep the cash. Mm-hmm. They can pass that cash through dividends to their stockholders. So you have nothing to lose. Why not buy PG&E?
This is a perfect storm. I mean, because we have climate change. We have very, very dry weather. We have a drought. But we also have something else. And I'd like the three of you to also comment on it. I'm looking at a Bloomberg News report. Quote, it's a land use issue, said Alice Hill, a senior advisor for climate resilience to President Barack Obama. Without so many homes being constructed in vulnerable areas at the edge of the forest, we would still have fires, but we wouldn't have this kind of devastation. A paradox of California's wildfire epidemic is that it already has one of the most aggressive building codes in the nation. The state uses the most up-to-date version of model national codes and doesn't allow local governments to opt out of those codes. It also requires that homes in areas with the highest risk of wildfire get built with fire-resistant materials and construction techniques. So here's the state of California saying, okay, we have to have a zoning plan and a building plan that sort of mitigates against the possibility of something like this happening.
Mm-hmm.
And California, according to this former Obama official and according to the Bloomberg News report, California is not at the end of the spectrum. It's at the top of the spectrum in terms of responsible governance. And yet, because of land use and because of construction, because of really the, let's face it, more or less unfettered development of capitalism,
yep,
through real estate and landlordism and profit, that's what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, there's three things at play, right? There's, you know, the what is natural, which is that, you know, sometimes wildfires happen in
every year.
Every year, right? You have climate change making the weather much, much drier. So there's a drought in California, and so that means that, you know, whatever natural wildfires happen because of, you know, lightning or whatever, that's that much worse. And then human societies become more and more vulnerable to the effects of, you know, climate change enhanced wildfires because of the social system, because of the system of private property where, you know, the right to profit sort of trumps all else.
Yeah. You know, I want to just finish up on this, John. There's not only do we have climate change, dry weather, there's Hurricane Gale winds.
That oh, yeah. Are,
and this is not an anomaly. That every year,
no, it happens
big
every
winds.
Year. Yeah.
Yeah. So here's a situation where people more or less know the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we have 600 people plus missing, over 60 dead, and we're not done.
Yeah, it's terrible. And the really bad thing about the building policies is the California doesn't want to charge the homeowners who are building in these areas, in these higher risk areas. They don't want to charge the developers. They'll do some retrofitting, but they don't want to force homeowners to pay for these costs. But these are not working class poor people. These are people who are choosing to build their homes in exclusive areas that are very, very pricey. So it's interesting who pays for climate change and who doesn't.
Yeah, you can't escape class politics, even when it comes to a natural disaster, so-called.
And if I can add 5 seconds worth of comment. We also see this when there are mudslides. You know, sometimes California, especially Southern California, has very, very heavy rains. They all sort of happen all at the same time. And these enormous mansions just slide down the side of the mountain. Those are also wealthy people who choose to build their homes on the sides of mountains. It's the same thing that you're talking about, Jackie, where people are choosing to build their homes in high-risk wildfire areas. And then they want everybody else to pay for it.
And even if you're not in sort of like the direct path of the flames, if the air quality in California, all over California, including the highly densely populated parts, is just absolutely terrible. And, you know, people aren't getting the day off work. You know, if you work outside, and this is particularly important for farm workers who are so deeply exploited and oppressed in California, they're not getting the day off work because it's extremely hazardous to go outside and breathe this extremely smoky and dust-filled air. You know, they still have to go to work.
Yeah, we saw a headline a couple of days ago that said wildfires and natural disasters are the great equalizer because people who are celebrities and people who are rich, people like Miley Cyrus or, you know, people who
right,
have
Neil Young,
because their homes also, guess what, actually do burn, that they are now equal with the poor, with the working class. Well, that's not true.
No.
mean, yes, all of their homes are flammable. If that's the level, if that's what we mean by equality, it's a very, very low bar.
Yeah.
Let's go on to another story. Of course, big story. And Jacqueline and John, I know you're following, and Walter, you may be following, so we'll get all of your comments. The recount in Florida goes on and on.
Well, apparently one of the recounts doesn't go on, because I think the recount for the governor's race from Broward County and Palm Beach, Broward County submitted their recount results. This is like over a million ballots. They submitted them electronically like at 2:45. I think the cutoff was at 3:00, but it took 17 minutes for the upload.
Yeah, yesterday.
Yesterday.
Right.
So there were 2 minutes late. The results were received by the state 2 minutes late. So the state invalidated those results.
Fascism.
I don't know if it's fascism, but it's pretty stunning. So yeah. They're done. So that's it
for the governor's race.
Yeah, for the governor's race.
Yeah.
MSNBC and CNN both said this morning that DeSantis is the winner. The Republican is the winner. They've called it
right.
And it's because those ballots are being invalidated.
Right. And this is from Broward and Palm Beach County.
The most heavily Democratic counties in all of Florida.
Yeah. And the two counties that have never seen any kind of real reform or correction from 2000.
Mm-hmm. And don't forget that Rick Scott appointed the election overseer for Palm Beach County.
Oh, yes, for Palm Beach County.
2 minutes late, and how many votes are invalidated?
What, 1.6 million, I think, out
crazy.
Of a county of 2 million people.
1.6 million people are disenfranchised, mm-hmm. not because they did something wrong.
That's right.
But because the officials in charge of tabulating the vote were 2 minutes late.
And we can't even say that the officials were late, because they submitted it with...
Right, the officials were not late.
No,
yeah.
No, they hit the button. They hit the send button in time.
They absolutely hit the send button in time.
Okay. What comes next? Is this going to go to court?
That's it, it's done.
As far as the election is concerned, that's done. But I'm hoping for lawsuits. I'm hoping for lots and lots of lawsuits. And I'm hoping for some serious change in the way elections are validated. I mean, in what I do for a living, you know, you have a send receive receipt. You know, no matter what time somebody receives an email, they can look at the send, see what time you sent it.
That's right.
And say, okay, well, you did try to say, you did send it on time. Something happened with the, I don't, why does that not happen here?
That's amazing. Disgusting. Amazing.
It's repulsive.
Wow, 1.6 million people disenfranchised.
That is that's not the American way. You know,
or maybe it is.
Well, and maybe it is. Maybe it is.
It kind of is. It kind
of
is.
I'm only laughing. Yeah. Of the system that we have.
I'm only laughing because it is so incredibly absurd. It's just absurd.
Let's go on. Where else are we not done counting?
The Florida and the Florida Senate race.
And the Georgia governor's race went to court today.
Yeah, the Senate race triggered was so close, less than 0.4% triggered an automatic hand count. So they are literally picking a certain segment of paper ballots and counting them by hand now. And for the Senate race between Rick Scott and Bill Nelson. But again, like we talked about for weeks and weeks, for almost a year, John, if Bill Nelson had better politics, this race wouldn't have been close.
You're absolutely right. This is Bill Nelson's fault. You can't be, what was it, three-term incumbent senator in a state like Florida and just lose.
Yeah.
It's because you're a bad politician.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
He coasted for a long time. And remember, Jackie, we said how many times that Rick Scott had literally unlimited resources.
Yes.
And so Bill Nelson didn't take that seriously until the end of the summer, and it was too late.
He phoned it in like 6 weeks before the actual election. It was ridiculous. But Georgia is a different story because Georgia, I think, as well as the Florida governor's race and a lot of these other Senate races where you've got these really frightening, clearly right wing, nearly white supremacist Republican candidates. This election, this midterm election, if more than I think any other, starkly reveals the problem of white supremacy in this country, because the Georgia governor's race and the Georgia governor's race and the Florida governor's race would never have been close. I mean, DeSantis spoke four times at a conference organized by a white supremacist and a Holocaust
denier. In Chicago, Jackie, remember we talked about that man who was accused of being a neo-Nazi, and he said, "I'm not a neo-Nazi. I'm a Nazi." He got 60,000 votes.
He did.
In a Democratic district, he got 60,000 votes.
So we've got a confluence of a whole bunch of different issues that we haven't paid attention to in this country, whether it's bad election procedure, it's outdated election process, it's bad oversight, but it's also white supremacy that's gone unaddressed that people are voting for. They know what these candidates are saying and what they believe in, and they're voting for them.
That's the voice of Jacqueline Lookman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on Facebook. We're also talking, of course, with John Kiriakou, the co-host of this show, Loud and Clear, and in-studio Sputnik news analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. This segment is our new Week in Review segment. And we're looking forward to it. We're going to spend the first 30 minutes talking about domestic issues, whatever is hot, what's new, what's big inside the United States. The second 30 minutes about the international situation and U.S. international military and foreign policy. Jacqueline and John Kiriakou, the two of you have been running every week here on Loud and Clear, a segment that I rarely participate in because I truly don't follow these events the way the two of you do.
I love them. I'm fascinated by them.
Well, the two of you are real true experts on what's going on in electoral politics. And I want you now looking back, now that this congressional midterm election is over and the already presidential election has already begun, let's just take a step back. Are you surprised in terms of what's actually happened with the change in the House? And what's happened in the Senate? The Republican majority in the Senate has grown. A week and a half ago when we were talking about the elections, it looked like the Democrats had gained a few more seats to take the majority in the House. It's actually a lot more than that.
A lot more.
So let's just try to sum up and see what the big takeaways are here. Jacqueline, let's start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm surprised on one hand by the level, like I said, of how white supremacy is just, it's just out there now and it's blatant and it's obvious. And a lot of these GOP Senate candidates aren't even hiding it. They're not walking back on a lot of it. And I think I'm surprised, not that that's true, but I'm surprised at how weak the Democrats' response to them has been. Because, I mean, it's not new. So I think the Democrats had a chance to do better in the Senate. If they had a stronger message on actual values and real policies, but they didn't focus on those things at all. So the GOP did what the GOP does. And so, you know, they kept the Senate, which we said for a year they were going to do.
In fact, we both predicted that they would pick up a seat or two.
Yeah. And that's exactly what they did. They picked up, I think, two seats in the Senate. The House race, that's really interesting how it eventually turned out.
I'm surprised because of all those very, very close races, 70% of them have broken for the Democrats.
Yeah. And I think that does speak to this insurgence, and I do like the word insurgence, of more progressive politics and politicians within the Democratic Party. They're resonating more with voters than the Democratic Party even likes.
Well, the Democrats got more votes in the House races than the Republicans.
Yeah, mm-hmm. A lot more.
They got more in the Senate. I can't remember the number. Yes. It might have been.
That was 12 million. Is that accurate?
Or 9 million. I don't remember the exact.
It's a lot.
Yeah. It's a lot. And yet the Republicans picked up more Senate seats, which shows, again, that the conservative and more rural parts of the country have an undue oversized influence in politics. 81% of the United States lives in urban or suburban areas. That's certainly not reflective in terms of how the outcomes are in these races. But let's also, just sort of looking ahead, does this outcome in the midterms signal anything about, in a predictive way, about what might be coming in 2020? Ohio used to be a swing state, appears now to be a Republican state. Florida is always a swing state, but it went Republican.
Yep.
And when you look at some of the sub data in county by county in Florida, actually it would seem to be pretty good for Donald Trump going forward, because also Florida is changing in the sense that even more wealthy white people from the North, wealthy people who are traditionally Republican and conservative, are coming to Florida because of all of the incentives given retirees.
Right.
Huge incentives.
No state income tax, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's changing the demographic. So when we think about, okay, Arizona went from a Republican senator, Jeff Flake's seat, went to Sinema, the Democrat at the end of the day. Nevada, now a Democrat in the Senate, also the governorship. Those states appear to be no longer red states, per se. But Florida and Ohio, those are important in terms. It might not be such a bad outcome in terms of Donald Trump and the Republicans.
And keep in mind that in American history, no Republican has ever won the presidency without carrying Ohio. So really, Ohio is the bellwether. Mm. And if it becomes more and more Republican, which I agree with you, Brian, I think it is. I'm not sure why, but it is. That's going to be a problem for the Democrats, especially if the Democrats are going to keep losing Florida by a whisker.
Yeah. And I do think this midterm really does kind of signal what's going to happen in 2020. Not only do the Democrats not have a real strong contender against the messaging of Donald Trump, as toxic and horrible as it is, they really don't have a strong contender against the messaging of Donald Trump. They don't have the kind of populist enthusiasm. Not the old guard Democrats, not the establishment Democrats, the infighting that's going to start in the Democratic Party, that has already started in the Democratic Party with these new progressives coming in. That's going to have to happen, but it's not going to help them in 2020.
NPR interviewed Steny Hoyer this morning. It was so interesting because they asked him exactly that question. How are you going to placate these young, aggressive, progressive winners in your caucus now?
Mm.
Because they don't like the fact that Nancy Pelosi has been around forever and she's 78 years old, et cetera, et cetera. And he said that they're talking about giving them newly created positions in the caucus, vice chairman of the caucus, chairman of the conference. And maybe that's the way to placate them. I think he's wrong.
We have 3 minutes left in this segment on domestic issues in the Week in Review. So I want to go really quickly and try to cover a couple of them, maybe just 1 minute. What happened to all the talk about the caravan, Jackie? I mean, Donald Trump was, you know, every day on TV, the invasion is coming, the hordes are coming.
No.
And now you have thousands of U.S. soldiers deployed on the border. They're not happy because the assignment is like a political stunt. They're actually suffering. They're away from their families. They know it's a political stunt. What happened to the caravan? 30 seconds on this, and then I want to cover a couple other quick stories.
This $40 to $110 million caravan, that money isn't going to go to, you know, combat pay or extra pay for those deployed troops. You're right. It was nothing but a political stunt. Secretary of Defense Mattis didn't even want to do it. But Trump is his commander-in-chief.
Commander-in-chief. Let's go to another story. Jamel Roberson, security guard, African-American man, a hero, stopped a mass shooting in a bar in the Chicago area. The police arrived. He has subdued the suspect, shot dead. A tragic story, a terrible story, a murderous story. Anyway, 30 seconds on that, and I want to go to one last story. Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, as usual, there are all these conflicting accounts of this story. The witnesses in the bar say that Roberson had... He was identified to the police officer who shot him as security, whether he had a T-shirt on that had security emblazoned on it or whether people just shouted at the cop telling him he is security. That really is the only thing that matters, that the police knew that this man was security. He was also licensed to carry that gun. He shouldn't be dead, but he is. So here we are again.
Yeah. Disgusting. Last story. 1 minute left. Donald Trump gave Elvis Presley a Medal of Freedom award. That's bizarre.
And Babe Ruth.
But giving Elvis a medal, I mean, actually, Trump is actually doing something.
Yeah.
It's bizarre, but there's a message here. What is it?
Yeah, the message is that this is what American values are supposed to look like. Because if we ignore Elvis, then we look at the other people that he gave the medal to. And Sheldon Adelson's wife is the other person.
Yep. Elvis and Sheldon Adelson's wife.
Mm-hmm.
Because Sheldon Adelson's wife has done so much to promote the country and to make the country a better place.
Well, he couldn't give the medal to Sheldon Adelson.
Quick, what's her first name?
Oh, shoot. I have it here.
I don't have any idea
Miriam.
What her first
Miriam.
Name is.
Miriam. Yeah, it's Miriam.
You guys should stay up with the news. All right, we're going to take a short break. This is The Week in Review with Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we begin our new hour-long segment that we're calling The Week in Review. This is going to be the second half hour of that hour. We'll talk about the most important events of the week and offer some analysis to put it all in perspective. In this half hour, we're going to talk about international and foreign policy issues. We're joined in studio by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of the Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on Facebook. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
All right, Walter, I said in the first segment that you weren't an expert on U.S. electoral politics.
It's true. That's true.
You're pleading guilty to that. But you are following European politics closely. What's going on in the UK, if you think back to where it was 2 years ago when Theresa May, well, we had the unexpected referendum outcome for Brexit, the leaving of the UK from the EU, the people who introduced that referendum, which would have been the Tory party, the Conservative Party, they expected this would be ratified and thus they'd have a clear road ahead. But instead, the majority by a 53-47% vote voted no. They wanted to leave the EU. Then that prime minister had to step down. Theresa May came in to be the leader of the Tories and thus the prime minister of the UK. She then had to start negotiating a Brexit deal. In order to strengthen her hand, she had a snap election because she figured, okay, now we can bury the Labour Party because it has that extreme left-wing Jeremy Corbyn as its leader. But instead of burying the Labour Party shot up and Theresa May's government became a Conservative government, dependent on a small Protestant right-wing dinosaur party, the DUP, with its 10 votes in Parliament to hang on to a majority that way. The Labour Party is now the largest party in Europe, I think. It has 500,000 new members under Jeremy Corbyn's left-wing leadership. And this week, maybe we see the beginning of the end of Theresa May. Anyway, talk about what's happened.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I think, you know, if it's one of the very few bright spots in the world, the possibility, maybe the imminent possibility that Jeremy Corbyn could become the prime minister of the UK. But yeah, I mean, just to sort of start from the beginning, you know, I think it's important to remember why the Conservative Party, then it was led by Prime Minister David Cameron, decided to call this referendum in the first place. And that's because there was a far right party in the UK called the UK Independence Party. And they were, you know, very rapidly digging or eating into the support base of the Conservative Party. And so David Cameron said, OK, well, you know, to sort of stave that off, to placate that sort of wing of politics, we're going to have this referendum, which we know will win. And then that'll sort of just put the issue to rest. But that's not what happened. They made a huge blunder. And so now Cameron had to resign. Theresa May is now the prime minister, and she's in charge of presiding over, you know, what's really an almost impossible task. You know, they have to implement this policy that the majority of their own party doesn't really want to do. It's extremely complicated because of the business interests. I mean, the enormous amount of money that's tied up in terms of the trade between the UK and the European Union. London is, you know, one of maybe second only to New York City in terms of like financial centers of the world. And so, you know, the legal complications, the bureaucratic complications. There's another issue with Northern Ireland, right, which was, engulfed in an armed struggle 20 years ago, not too long ago. The, you know, stability of that region is, I think, in large part as a result of, you know, Ireland is in the European Union, the UK is and, you know, was stably in the European Union. And so that border wasn't such a big deal. Now that border, you know, there's a possibility of it becoming what people are calling a hard border, quote unquote. So there's all these different political complications that come along with this. And so now Theresa May has agreed with the European Union negotiators on like a draft agreement.
Let's talk about what the draft agreement is. Let's talk about what it means as a customs union. And again, I think a lot of people in the United States don't know these terms. They won't know what this really means. The free movement of people, what does that mean? And what's offered in the deal? Doesn't it in fact mean that if Britain stays in the customs union, the EU rules apply to Britain, but Britain no longer has a say in EU decision making? So the critics say, well, look, we're still kind of in the EU, at least for the next couple of years, but we just don't have any say now. And that's a bad deal.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, the sticking point as the negotiations came down to the wire, and the deadline, by the way, is March. So as the negotiations came down to the wire, the issue of Northern Ireland was really the one sticking point that they just couldn't come to an agreement on. And basically the compromise that this draft deal implements is it's what's being referred to in the media as like a backstop. So in the event that there isn't an arrangement worked out between the UK and the EU on economic issues and, you know, the free movement of people, then there would basically be an exception for Northern Ireland where just that part of the UK, whether that's just or not that they're part of the UK, whether, you know, they would basically remain in the European common market. And then, you know, Theresa May is saying, well, you know, it's just a temporary thing, right? The backstop is just a temporary backstop, but it doesn't actually have an expiration date, is what the critics point out. There's sort of mandated reviews of the backstop exception for Northern Ireland that happens periodically, but never a point where it's just like, okay, now this is the cutoff date.
And Jeremy Corbyn, of course, as a progressive, as a leftist, as a socialist, also supports a united Ireland. The idea that the six provinces of Northern Ireland are the same as any other part of the UK is just nonsense. This is a colonial detachment, a colonial outpost. It was the part of Ireland that was not able to break free during the Irish Liberation Revolution that happened in the early 1920s. It's an occupation. And the DUP, the Protestant Reactionary Right-Wing Dinosaur Party, which now, without whom Theresa May's government can't actually stand, they can't pass a majority vote, they say, well, we insist that that Northern Ireland be treated just like any other part of the UK, which, of course, could undo the Good Friday Agreement, whereby the war being waged by Irish freedom fighters in Northern Ireland could come apart, because the premise of that deal was that there would be a soft border between the six provinces in the north and the rest of the Republic of Ireland, meaning that they were really functioning as one people, one nation, even though there was still a border.
And, you know, that point you raised about Jeremy Corbyn being a supporter of a united Ireland, I think that's the key difference, because people say, like, oh, you know, Jeremy Corbyn is like the British Bernie Sanders, right? And, you know, in certain ways, that's true, right? Because, you know, they represent this sort of, you know, young, more left-wing support base, right? But I think the key difference is that Jeremy Corbyn is truly an anti-war, anti-imperialist person. So, you know, the Labour Party was in charge of the Iraq War under Tony Blair. Jeremy Corbyn was an ardent opponent of the Iraq War. He was an activist in the 1980s and before against apartheid in South Africa. I mean, he's a supporter of the Palestinian people. Like, these are things that I think put him in sort of like a qualitatively different league than Bernie Sanders.
I just have to say, picking up on that point, I was the perhaps central organizer of a demonstration on January 18, 2003, 2 months before the Iraq invasion. 500,000 people showed up. Bernie Sanders did not come to speak at that protest, but guess who did come to speak to that protest?
Jeremy Corbyn.
And so Jeremy Corbyn came all the way from the UK to show that as a backbencher and as an anti-war activist, he was here in solidarity with the American people who were trying to stop this war of aggression from happening before it started. Jeremy Corbyn came. We didn't pay his way. He came. He spoke.
Wow.
Those politicians, some of whom say they're very, very liberal or left, very few of them showed up. John Conyers, I have to say, did show up. Dennis Kucinich showed up, but not many. It was a paltry turnout. And that was when most of the country was opposed to a pending, looming war of choice, the so-called war of choice in Iraq. Let's go on to another story. Here it is. Justice Department mistakenly reveals indictment against WikiLeaks Julian Assange. That's amazing revelation came out by accident, apparently. I don't know if it was by accident. We're going to do another segment about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, but this is pretty big news. This is exactly why Julian Assange has not come out of the Ecuadorian embassy. The United Nations rules that his continued stay in the Ecuadorian embassy is nothing other than arbitrary detention. That's the UN rapporteur who made that ruling. Normally, that has the weight of law almost, but he's still holed up there. What do you think, John? You followed this case closely.
I have, and I'm very, very disappointed. So yesterday, an assistant U.S. attorney filing a case in the Eastern District of Virginia, I guess inadvertently admitted that Julian Assange has been charged and the charge has been sealed. This was an unrelated case. It was just an accident. This AUSA was trying to file a case on terrorism and child pornography, and Assange's name just came out.
Wow.
Yeah, and unfortunately, this is what we had been predicting, that if he were to be charged, it would be in the Eastern District of Virginia. The Eastern District of Virginia is called the Espionage Court. It's also called the Rocket Docket, because everything happens more quickly than in any other federal court in America. Well, it's called the Espionage Court because no national security defendant has ever won a case there. Ever.
Wow.
That's amazing.
It's terrible.
That's not a court then.
No, that's not a court. You know, I made a joke the other day in another interview, and it wasn't really a joke, but I said when I was at the CIA working on Iraq and Saddam Hussein would run for re-election and he'd get 98%, we would laugh and say that the fix was in. Well, the Justice Department wins 98.2% of its cases, and we say they're geniuses. Well, something's wrong here. So Julian likely will be charged in the Eastern District of Virginia, and knowing Judge Leonie Brinkema, she sets aside all national security cases for herself.
Oh.
She tried me. She tried Jeffrey Sterling. She has the Ed Snowden case. She did Zacharias Moussaoui. So it's likely that she'll get Julian, and she's a hanging judge. She also is a former prosecutor and a Reagan appointee who was elevated from administrative to criminal judge by Bill Clinton. So my guess, and it's not even a guess, but an educated guess, is that Julian is doomed if he's thrown out of that embassy.
Yeah.
Or if he voluntarily leaves and is extradited to the United States. He doesn't stand a chance. We ought to be having a conversation now about jury nullification, because I think that's what it's going to come down to.
Yeah, and unfortunately, with the climate, the political climate in this country from the White House, some people's attitude toward the media and journalists, more than half the country wants Julian Assange imprisoned, or worse, honestly, because that's the narrative that 45 is putting out about journalists and you know, anybody who basically opposes him.
And you know the CNN went to file a court case about the Jim Acosta losing his press pass. By the way, a federal district court, I think, just restored.
Yeah. Breaking news.
Breaking news.
Yeah, they ordered the White House to let Acosta back in.
But where is CNN to talk about Julian Assange?
Not a word.
I mean, they use all of these revelations from WikiLeaks. Where's the New York Times? They use all the revelations from WikiLeaks. Where's the Guardian? Where is the Washington Post? Washington Post is glad to use WikiLeaks as a media outlet and as a source. I don't hear them saying a word. So they defend CNN, which, of course, from the point of view of its politics, is nothing other than an echo chamber for the Pentagon.
Absolutely.
Whether they're Republican or Democrat, it's an echo chamber. They're glad to use Julian Assange's media revelations, including things that he said about the Iraq war, revelations, the Iraq war logs, for instance, where we could see U.S. Apache attack helicopter pilots shooting down journalists and Iraqi civilians and Iraqi children civilians.
Yes.
Those, the Pentagon refused to release that tape. WikiLeaks got the tape. Reuters, by the way, had filed a public records request. They didn't get it. So WikiLeaks got it. WikiLeaks gave it to us. We know about it because of their work, and none of the media that used it stands up for them.
Yeah. I mean, it's a question of free press. And, you know, we have large number of media outlets that we have access to here in the United States, but they all say, I think, more or less the same thing. I mean, you can have a vigorous debate, say, between, you know, people on Fox News and MSNBC, but it's all constricted to sort of a pretty narrow range of opinion. For instance, you're not allowed to challenge the war machine. I mean, that's one thing that MSNBC and Fox News agrees on, that the United States should have the biggest military ever, the Pentagon is great, and that the United States is the exceptional country that can go all around the world and impose its will. You know, that's not up for debate. But when you have media outlets, and I think it's absolutely essential to keep stressing that point, WikiLeaks is a media outlet,
right,
that they come along and they do question and challenge some of those assumptions, all of a sudden they're vilified.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, there's not going to be anyone, because of not just how Trump is treating journalists and the media. But remember, Obama wasn't friendly to whistleblowers either. So
it took my attorneys a full year to get the mainstream media to stop calling me CIA leaker John Kiriakou,
right,
and to start calling me CIA whistleblower John Kiriakou.
Yeah. So
a full year.
So it's not any surprise that Julian Assange is not going to have a whole lot of public support in pushing back for real justice or fairness.
Well, let me add something to that. That's an important point. A friend of mine on Facebook just posted something that really goes directly to what you're saying. And that is, he said, well, you might like Julian Assange, but he worked with the Russians to get Trump elected.
That's actually where this is going big time, because if we go back to 2016, the revelations of Hillary Clinton's emails, the DNC's emails that showed that the DNC was rigging the primary so that Hillary Clinton could get her coronation because she demanded it.
Right.
Not Bernie Sanders, who had grassroots support all over the country, 80% of the youth vote. They rigged those primaries.
Yep.
They rigged the process such that Hillary Clinton, who was paying all the DNC bills, could actually have that outcome. Now, the Democrats said, well, those came from the Russians.
Right. And remember, Julian said that those documents came from a disgruntled DNC employee who was angry that the Hillary campaign had stolen the election from Bernie Sanders.
So we have a situation where the Mueller probe hasn't come out with any indictments that now, as of now, show actual Russian collusion with the Trump campaign. But something like this sort of fills the blank spots. It fills the gaps because WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, Russia, the narrative, the emails, the blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's where this is going.
I think it's politically convenient. It's caught on. It's become, you know, an article of faith in political establishment circles because it serves two very important political functions. On the domestic front, it allows the Democratic Party, I would call them the right-wing leadership of the Democratic Party, to explain away the huge shock that they suffered in the 2016 presidential election, where they, just assumed that, well, you know, it's Donald Trump. We're against Donald Trump. And so, you know, no matter who our candidate is and no matter how unpopular their policies are, we're going to win. And that's not what happened. And so this provides an explanation for that. On the international front, it allows the United States to engage in what the Pentagon calls great power competition. China, Russia, those are the big competitors for the United States. And, you know, this allows that escalation ladder to continue to be climbed.
Let's go on to some other quick stories. The Saudis, under the leadership of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, say they're actually going to seek the death penalty for the perpetrators of the crime. Now, no, that's not an announcement about suicide from Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince. That means he's got some fall guys. I mean, John Kiriakou, you know a lot about Saudi Arabia. If the crown prince and the Saudi leadership are saying to the people who they pretty obviously directed, once caught, that they're actually going to cut their heads off.
Right.
I mean, that seems like a destabilizing tactic in terms of an internal form of rule.
I'm going to make a prediction. Arab culture is such that when someone kills another person, the government will go to the victim's family and say, "We'll behead this person, or they can pay blood money to you, and their lives will be spared." My guess is there's a whole lot of money that's going to change hands in the coming months.
Wow.
And nobody's going to be executed.
Okay, granted. But again, if Mohammed bin Salman or any political leadership has trusted people and they send them on, operations, and then the operations go awry.
Right.
And then they publicly say, "Well, we're going to put you to death."
Right. That is indeed destabilizing.
It makes it a little hard to recruit the next group of confidants, no?
I mean, yeah.
That means Mohammed bin Salman's stature internationally, nobody wants to go have a photo op with him, right?
Right.
Nobody else.
Right.
Nobody wants to. Maybe Mike Pence or, Donald Trump Jr. or Jared Kushner. But most people right now, no photo op with Mohammed bin Salman. Okay, so he's weakened on the international arena. At the same time, he needs a loyal coterie of followers, of minions to do his bidding internally because he's shut down in the past all the other factions, put them under arrest at the hotel, put a gun to their head, tortured some of them, demanded, hundreds of millions of dollars, extortionate, like this is your get out of jail card.
Right, right.
How does he, doesn't it point to a weakened, no matter what, a weakened Mohammed bin Salman who seemed to be
without
having dictatorial power?
Without a doubt, this is a blow.
Yeah.
This is a blow, not just to his stature in the region, as an aggressive young leader, but it's a blow internally in the kingdom.
I actually don't think he's going to remain as the crown prince. I have no idea how they're going to get
rid of him.
Okay,
you heard it here first. Jacqueline Lookman is predicting the...
Well, there may be something to that. Because
a number of people are making similar predictions.
Yeah, there's a precedent for it. And, Saudi Arabia has this family council.
Mm-hmm.
And it has thousands of princes who are members of the family council.
Yes.
And every major personnel decision, king, crown prince, heir presumptive, they're all approved by the family council. This was not approved by the family council. No council meeting was called.
Right.
And so there's resentment inside the family.
And you also have here in the United States, because of all of this mess, you have Lindsey Graham and the leadership of the Republican Party saying they don't want to do business with Saudi Arabia as long as bin Salman is the crown prince.
Yeah, they want to pressure him, Walter. They want to get, Lindsey Graham clearly wants to get rid of him. We don't know exactly why. I think Lockheed Martin is the biggest donor to Lindsey Graham's campaign. Maybe there are some unpaid bills or something from
and
the
Saudi. Absolutely because of the arms deal.
Yeah, for sure. I think the other thing is that like it doesn't actually matter to the United States who the it's the regime is what matters to them and not like the individual. I mean, Jared Kushner, because he's like friends with Mohammed bin Salman, maybe he has a
they talk
preference.
Every day, I think.
That's a little frightening.
Yeah,
little
it really
creepy.
Is. But they're pretty similar people.
Mohammed bin Salman owns real estate that he's driving poor people out of in the Baltimore suburbs? No, that's Jared Kushner.
That's
right,
Jared
Kushner. Mohammed bin Nayef, for instance, is one of the princes who was purged in the... I think he was actually the crown prince.
He was. He was the crown prince, and before that, he was the director of the Saudi Intelligence Service.
And a favorite of the CIA.
The favorite. The favorite of the CIA, yes.
They're screwing over their friends, the CIA's friends and the U.S. government's friends who, are sort of tried and true and loyal and, like, reliable people. So, wouldn't the U.S. government kind of prefer that it's, like, a more reliable and stable proxy regime rather than this, like, 30-year-old kid who's going to start wars?
He's 32.
Killing people willy-nilly in the consulate
and
stuff.
Let's go on to another story. Demonstrations broke out in Israel because there was a ceasefire. I mean, where else in the world are there street protests because peace has temporarily been arranged? But while that happened, while that ceasefire happened between the Netanyahu government and Hamas, not only street protests in Israel by right-wing, even more right-wing than Benjamin Netanyahu demonstrators, but Netanyahu's government started to come. It started to come undone.
Yeah, sure. So there are two political parties in Israel that are to the right of the Likud, which is Benjamin Netanyahu's party. There's the party of Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman, who resigned in protest and in shock that, you know, oh, wow, the bombing might come to an end. Or actually that the bombing that Israel did carry out, which was devastating, was not intense enough or maybe was not accompanied by a ground operation. So there's his party. And then there's the Jewish Home Party of Education Minister Naftali Bennett, also to the right of, shockingly, Benjamin Netanyahu. And so, you know, there's an election due next year. Now it looks like that election is going to happen a lot earlier than expected, maybe in a couple months. And so, you know, these right-wing forces are all sort of jockeying for position to say, like, who can be the most right-wing, who can be the most aggressive and racist towards the Palestinian people.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting that Lieberman quit because of the ceasefire. But at the same time, Netanyahu is allegedly brokering this peace deal with Hamas. The IDF is at the same time carrying out a covert operation inside the Gaza Strip that went wrong.
Every day, every hour. And when they talk about covert operations that went wrong, what you actually have is Gaza is essentially occupied. It's formally not occupied. The West Bank is occupied formally. Mm-hmm. The Golan Heights, also seized in the 1967 war, occupied. You have Israeli intelligence agents and IDF covert operations, commandos, going in and routinely snatching Palestinians in their own homes, in their own neighborhoods, and then either killing them or taking them to prison where they're routinely tortured. I mean, that's the reality. When they say an intelligence operation gone awry, it means they ran into armed resistance.
Right.
That's right.
Right. And they killed more people than they expected to in public.
But what wouldn't have been, according to the U.S. mainstream media, it wouldn't have been awry if they had just gone in and successfully kidnapped some Palestinians or successfully neutralized or killed them. It's a different status than almost anywhere else in the world right now. It's like the South African apartheid regime, which didn't really try to pretend that it was something other than what it was because it was so obvious about what it was. And Walter, you know, again, it speaks to the need, the Palestinians in Gaza, the Palestinians in the West Bank, if they're left to themselves against this preponderant military power backed by the biggest military power in the world and in world history, the Palestinians, no matter how just their cause is, it won't fully be realized. They need the BDS, and that's growing. That actually is happening. I think what happened this week will accelerate that process.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think, you know, there's been a major shift in public opinion in the United States where, you know, Israel, as opposed to being this sort of by like total consensus, like this is our ally, you know, that's starting to crack a little bit. I think significantly it's starting to crack among young progressive Jewish people, too. And so I think that, there are two essential things that people around the world can do to help the Palestinian people. One is, like Brian was saying, the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanction. And the other thing is that the U.S. military provides, or the U.S. government provides, it used to be $3 billion, now I think it's closer to $4 billion a year in military aid to Israel. You know, the tear gas canisters that are used to repress the Palestinian demonstrators and the Great March of Return every month, they're produced, I believe, by CSI, which is a corporation in just north of Pittsburgh. I mean, this is like made in the USA.
We have 1 minute left, Jackie. UN lifts sanctions on Eritrea after 9 years. Talk about this story. Just a minute left. Take us out on this.
Eritrea had been accused of pretty much supporting al-Shabaab. And there was allegedly all this evidence that the UN Security Council gathered against Eritrea. Eritrea had been in a struggle for independence from Ethiopia. And then they were also at odds with Somalia. So there was all of this tension going on in Eritrea. And Eritrea has been fighting not only for its independence from Ethiopia, but also basically to clear its name and reputation from these allegations of their involvement with al-Shabaab. Well, now all of these efforts have paid off. They've been, quote unquote, proven innocent of these allegations of links to terrorism. The sanctions have been lifted, and it was helped by new leadership in Ethiopia, where the newly elected president of Ethiopia has mended fences with Eritrea. And now these three nations are improving their relations. So there might be some more stability in that region.
We're going to leave it right there. We're completely out of time. This is our new segment every Friday called The Week in Review. That was the voice of Jacqueline Lookman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on Facebook, and we were joined in studio by Sputnik news analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.